welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and joining me today is police procedural and crime author Paul Bishop. A little bit about our guest, a nationally renowned interrogator and behaviorist, Paul Bishop spent 35 years with the Los Angeles Police Department. His high-profile special assault units regularly produced the highest number of detective-initiated arrests and highest crime clearance rates in the city. He was twice selected as LAPD's Detective of the Year, and using his experience in deception detection, Paul now conducts interrogation seminars for law enforcement and arson investigators across the company. As part of Frontline Mind, an on-command state of clarity and action, enabling peak performance under pressure, Paul specializes in resiliency training and teaches PTSD coping skills for first responders, military, and special forces. A writer, a screenwriter, and television personality, his 15 books include five in his LAPD homicide detective Faye Croker series. His latest novel, Lie Catchers, begins a new series featuring top LAPD interrogators Ray Pagan and Calamity Jane Randall. And he's currently working on the sequel, Admit Nothing. And he's on the air with me today. Paul Bishop, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's great to have you on.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking time to chat with me.
All right. So Paul, I'm intrigued by your background as an LAPD detective. I'm glad you've turned to writing because I love police procedurals and investigation fiction, but I can't write it. If you don't have the experience, you just can't fake it. Can you share a bit about your career and how that experience has influenced your fiction writing?
Well, certainly. I really had two separate careers that informed each other. I started in 1977 with the Los Angeles Police Department, and I was very fortunate. I went in with a single-mindedness that I knew I wanted to be a detective, and usually takes anywhere from 7 to 10 years to get into the detective bureau as a trainee or to get promoted to detective, and I was fortunate to be back there within 2 years of coming on the job. Everybody starts out in uniform, and so within 2 years I was in detectives, and shortly after that, I by dint of two other detectives who work sex crimes in our division going on vacation together and asking me to cover for them, thinking that they had everything into hand, they leave, and the day after they leave, of course, Murphy's Law, I'm into the biggest sex crime case that they've had in the division in years. And that just kind of cemented that sex crimes was where I wanted to be and where I wanted to work. It's an investigative discipline that is in many ways the only subjective discipline left, and you have to make some real character judgments and other things that are employed in that. And so I spent 30 years working sex crimes, and the last 15 running a sex crimes unit with 30 detectives that we covered about 25% of the city. And in that 25% of the city at the end of the year, we not only had the highest clearance rate in the city, but it was the highest clearance rate by a wide margin. We're talking about having a 95% clearance rate for our unit, and the closest unit to us was 65%. And the difference for us was interrogations. It became the heart and soul of what we did, and we really worked hard to hone it in from a craft into an art. And that's how we ended up, clearing as many cases as we did and arresting as many people as we did. And when you interrogate people and you get to the truth of the matter, you don't spend as much time in court. So that's a win-win for everybody. And so all of that's a way of saying that's what's going on in my police career. But about 5 years into my police career, I always knew that I wanted to be a writer as well. And I started to get published professionally at that point. In other words, I was getting paid for writing articles and magazine pieces. And shortly after that, I had my first novel published, which was a Western, and then my first cop book, which was called Citadel Run, and is now renamed Hot Pursuit in its new incarnation on Amazon. So the two careers kind of ran parallel for the rest of the years, and now I'm kind of segueing away from one and into teaching and still continuing the writing. And that's where Lie Catchers came in, the latest book.
Well, I'm fascinated by this interrogation skill that you have of, you know, getting the truth from someone who's lying to you. And you've demonstrated some of this on the ABC television show Take the Money and Run. How do you know if someone is being truthful or not when you're interrogating them?
Well, I think it's a number of things. Truth has the ring of clarity to it. If somebody is telling you the truth, they're being open, they're being very insistent that what they're telling you is the truth, and you can hear it. You literally can hear the truth. Not so much so with lies, with deceptive behaviors. And deceptive behaviors are not just words. They come out in tone and intonation, body language, and timing, and any number of things. But think about it. If you were accused of something that you hadn't done, how insistent would you be that you hadn't done it? And if a detective or somebody is saying, yes, you did, yes, you did, and you are going to flatly, you're not going to let them tell you that you did it when you didn't. And that's something that I look for when I'm interrogating somebody. You know, how insistent are they? And if they're not insistent at all, if they're letting me turn the tables against them, and their protestations of innocence are getting weaker and weaker instead of stronger and stronger, that's a real good indication to me that I'm talking to somebody who's being deceptive.
Fascinating. And this Lie Catchers draws on that experience, correct? And it's your latest release. For our listeners who may not be familiar with that one yet, how would you describe Lie Catchers?
Well, it is a police procedural, but it's unlike any other police procedural I certainly have ever read, and I'm aware of it that's out there. As a writer, as all writers do, we look for a specific niche that we can mine that's different than everybody else writing in the same genre. So there are hundreds of thousands of police procedurals out there, and hundreds, if not thousands, of police procedural writers around today. How do I make myself different and stand out from what they're writing? And in going around the country and teaching interrogation, and it is so different than what you actually see on television, even on shows like 48 Hours, which purport to be, you know, real police documentary type things. My wife won't let me watch them because I'm yelling at the screen about all the things that the detectives are missing during the course of the interrogation and the things that they're doing wrong. And I teach to mostly experienced detectives. Usually they've got between 5 to 25 years on the job. And it's a 40-hour class, so Monday through Friday. And on Thursdays, invariably, some of the more experienced guys will come up to me, and they will be ticked off, but not at me. They'll be ticked off because they didn't have these techniques to draw on before. And they will always say something like, I saw that. I had this case. I saw that happen. I didn't know what it meant. If I'd only known it then, I would have had that guy. Because it's not the interrogations we get that stay with us. It's the ones that we don't that haunt us. And once I realized that, you know, experienced detectives are unaware of these techniques, clearly my readers were going to be unaware of these techniques. So what I set out to do was write a novel that was as close to what an interrogator does on a daily basis within a fictional setting, as close as I could get within that fictional setting. So everything that happens in Lie Catchers that the two main characters do is stuff that I have done or one of my detectives has done for good or ill. There are some questionable practices in there, but they're not illegal. And people will say, you know, how can you do that with people? How can you, you know, raise their anxiety and manipulate them like that? Well, that's my job. My job is to get the truth. We don't say my job is to get the confession out of somebody anymore because that word has come to have very bad overtones of, you know, bright lights and rubber hoses and all that kind of thing and being coerced. What I'm looking for is the truth. And that may be what the suspect is telling me. In sex crimes, I do spend a large percentage of my time actually getting victims to tell me the truth because of the embarrassing nature and the pressures of the crime and that type of thing. It's very hard to get to the heart of the matter with the victims, whereas if somebody is being burglarized or their car has been taken, it's pretty straightforward.
Well, I would just want to say, you know, thank you for the great work that you've done and are doing on behalf of those victims and to help get to the truth.
Yeah, I mean,
you've also written.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
I want to hear from you.
do you want me to give you one example of this? Of what I'm talking about.
That would be
okay.
Great.
So we had a case where my partner and I are called to a upscale high-rise hotel, and to one of the penthouse rooms where a female business executive is staying, and she is making claims that one of the parking garage attendants brought her keys up to her room after parking her car and assaulted her sexually. Well, you know, we were pretty quickly able to identify who this suspect was, and he's a tattooed up, hardcore gang member who has just been released from the California Youth Authority, which is a juvenile prison, basically, for rape. So this looks like a very straightforward case. You know, we go in lukewarm pursuit of the suspect, we pick him up, we bring him down to the station, put him in the interrogation room, do all the things that we do, and before we go in the room. And I walk in the room, and he takes one look at me, and he says, "Detective Bishop, don't even advise me of my rights. I'm going to tell you exactly what happened." Well, I'm thinking, okay, you're an idiot. You're going to jail. 2 hours later, my partner and I walk out of the room, and we looked at each other and go, "He didn't do this. What in the world is going on here?" So we went out and picked up the victim, brought her down to the police station. We have what we call a victim's room or a soft room where we put her, and within 15 minutes, she told us the truth that she had been doing this all across the country, where she stays at a high-end hotel, makes an allegation against a low-level employee, has him arrested, waits till the next day when the hotel's lawyers call her with a settlement, snags the money, and takes off before the case goes to court. And we identified 7 different places where she had done this across the country. Well, clearly she went to jail that night and not the bad guy. But here's the important part.
Wow.
If I didn't believe that he was telling me the truth, I could have very easily railroaded this guy not only into being arrested, to being booked, to being filed on by a friendly district attorney, but a jury buying off that he is the guy that did this just by looking at him. That's not my job. My job is to get to the truth.
Amazing. Yeah, that's scary to think how that could have gone without, you know, your skill that you've developed.
Well, I mean, there is the question, okay, will he go out and rape again? Is he that kind of person? He is a rapist. Well, again, that's not my job. Hopefully I can stop him from doing that. Hopefully he's, you know, but you know, it wouldn't have been right to put him in jail for something that he didn't do.
Yeah. So you've also written a series of novels about LAPD homicide detective and later Lieutenant Faye Croker. Tell us a bit about that series.
Well, I started writing Faye about 20 years ago now, and at that time, women were still experiencing a lot of sexism on the job, and we had no homicide supervisors in the department that were female. And so what I wanted to do with Faye was to make her the first divisional homicide unit supervisor and have her deal with all the things that entailed. Because of my background, I also wanted to I wanted to give Faye a very harsh upbringing where she was abused by her police officer father. But she isn't a victim of this. She isn't a survivor over it. She's a victor over it, and she uses it to drive her in what she does. So Faye is kind of a hard-bitten, fast-lipped, fast-witted, very hard-working detective. And I put her through five books, and the best blessing of that was when a female detective who had read the book would come up to me and say, "How do you know all this stuff? How do you know all this stuff?" And actually it came because almost all of my long-term partners on the job have been female, and I saw what they went through on a daily basis on the job and was able to capture that in Faye's character. So the neat thing is that the Faye books are currently being printed, reprinted rather, so Kill Me Again, the first book in the series, has come out, as well as Grave Sins. They are back out in trade paperback and new ebooks. And the other three books are to follow quickly in 2017, and I have been asked to do a new Faye Croker book by the publisher. And I said, okay, I don't want to write it as a period piece, so I will only do it if we can put a note at the front of the book that says, okay, yes, we understand time has elapsed, we're ignoring it. And just put her into a current modern-day situation, because I wanted to deal with current modern-day issues that are facing the police department. And so that book will be called Return to Duty.
Great. Yeah, look forward to that. And you've you actually answered a question that I was thinking about earlier today, just that you do tend to, more often than not, write about strong women as a protagonist or co-protagonist. And I do some of that also, and I'm often asked why. And, you know, my answer these days tends to be, well, why not? You know, women are the best, or, you know, something along those lines. But I also think,
right,
you know, women characters might break away from cliche in some plots, and there's, you know, maybe a wider emotional range that you can depict more convincingly with.
I think that's part of it, the wider emotional range. But with Faye, what was interesting is I wrote Faye in the third person. And that's one thing for a male writer, to write about a female in third person. And it really wasn't, you know, a terrific challenge or anything like that. She was a very strong character. But when I set out to write Lie Catchers, and we have these two characters, Ray Pagan and Calamity Jane Randall, Pagan is such an enigma. He is a complex, very odd personality. And I just, because interrogation is such an intimate art, I felt I had to write the book in the first person, because that's more intimate than third person. But I couldn't write it first person from Ray Pagan's perspective. It just wouldn't work. So I chose to write it from Jane's perspective in first person, as she tries to come to understand Pagan and his ways. And that I thoroughly enjoyed that. I mean, I just love Jane and spending time with these characters now.
That's great. Yeah, I write one of my characters is a first person young woman, Selena, in the series. And, you know, as I wrote that, I enjoyed it immensely. But at the same time, I was reminded of when I read Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, great book, great writer. But there were, you know, a couple of moments she wrote first person from the male perspective, Nick, and there would be something that came along and would just kind of take me out of the story, because I thought to myself, you know, men don't really think that way. So I wondered, as I was writing mine, how many millions of times I was doing the same thing. It's I found it challenging, but I enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, I think it's a fine line to tread, and you have to be constantly aware of it. There really is, and it's not good or bad, it's just different. There is a big difference between the way women's thought process goes and a male's thought process goes. Men have a tendency to report what happened. I did this, I did that. Women have a tendency to what we call rapport, as in, you know, you make rapport. They rapport. I felt this, I think this. And that's what I had to keep in mind when I was working in Jane's character.
Very interesting. You also mentioned Hot Pursuit or Citadel Run, the Calico
mm-hmm.
Jack Walker and Tina Tomiko. There was a bit of a true story behind that one, wasn't there?
Yes. Again, you know, as a writer, I'm always looking for something that's unique to what I can do, and I will stand by Citadel Run or Hot Pursuit as it's called now as being a one of a kind unique police procedural. Whether it's well written or not is up to the reader, but the actual plotting of itself, I don't think I've never seen anything like it. And it came from when I joined the department in 1977. Things were a lot different then, obviously. And our communication system was a lot different in the field. And we were never as busy as times have gotten now. We're here, patrol officers just race from call to call. Back in those days, especially if you worked morning watch, which was a graveyard shift, there was time to actually do proactive police work. There was time to patrol and talk to people and look at things. And you weren't always racing from call to call. But what guys would do as a jape sort of thing is somebody on morning watch, two guys in their patrol car, would either drive to Las Vegas and back or drive to Tijuana and back on duty in their police cars. They'd drive down to Tijuana and get their picture taken with a guy with a sombrero and the moth-eaten donkey, or they'd get the picture taken in front of a casino in Vegas and just to prove that they'd done it. And it was a macho, silly thing to do, granted. But you know, I thought, wow, this is a real basis for a story that I haven't seen done before. So I turned it into actually a grudge match between two sets of police officers. And Calico Jack Walker, who's 1 week away from retirement, and his rookie partner, Tina Tomiko, who is bound and determined to do make her a reputation, even though Calico is trying to keep her out of doing this thing, because if he gets caught in this race, he's going to lose not only his job, but his pension and everything else. And his sergeant, who hates him, is actually married to Calico's ex-wife. And so he is looking for any reason to get to Calico. And for me, that was enough of an antagonistic situation to get a story out of it. The issue was that driving to Vegas and back, or Tijuana and back, took almost the full 8 hours and 45 minutes of a shift. So I really couldn't have anything happen during the course of the race. Well, okay, that's kind of pretty boring. They were just driving there and driving back. And then I hit upon the solution, and that was to have the race occur on the night that the clocks get put back an hour, because morning watch always works the extra hour. And so now I've addressed the issue. I've got an extra hour to work with. My reader is going to go along with me even if I have an extra couple of hours of stuff happen along the way, because I've addressed the issue. So, and that was the basis behind Citadel Run. And then the follow-up to that was Sand Against the Tide. And again, I was looking for something different. And back in those days, we used to take all of the confiscated drugs and weapons from the evidence lockup to be destroyed, and we would put them on barges, big, huge barges, and you know, take them out into the ocean and dump them in the ocean. Well, over the years of, you know, this, you know, basically pollution, what's happened is all of a sudden whales are beaching themselves, and they've got traces of PCP in their brains and all of this kind of stuff. And so the ecologists are up in arms, and rightfully so. And there is a movement to put a stop to this, and instead of dumping it there, you know, the new idea is to burn it. Well, I decided that the last barge of weapons and drugs that's going to go out to be dumped is the perfect target for terrorists to get their weapons and their drugs and take over that barge and steal the millions of dollars worth of property that's on it. And so I thought, I've not seen that before. And so for me, those were you know, the perfect impetus to write a story about it.
Yeah, those are some unique hooks. Gonna shift gears here just a little. You know, this is a podcast, you know, that focuses on noir fiction. And Paul, you've written about how the peak of film noir in the late 40s and into the 50s emerged as a reaction on America's part to the population trying to turn from the darkness of World War II and to the American dream, and noir film is an exploration of the tension between these two experiences, an attempt to understand what if I were free of the stifling expectations of the American dream and had remained kind of a bad guy. Can you talk to us a little bit about that concept?
Right. I mean, I think film noir, which for me is the story of desperate people making desperate choices in a manner that ends up in a complete downward spiral with no happy ending. I think the reason for the popularity of that at the time is as we come back from World War II and women who have now been part of the workforce for a number of years are being taken out of the workforce and forced back into their roles, their traditional roles of mother and housekeeper and housewife and a personality that doesn't matter. I think that there was an understandable rebellion to being forced back into this stifling role. And I think men coming back from the war have been changed by war. They no longer felt comfortable in this happy family's environment. So I think that film noir, you know, which is populated with these strong female characters in many ways, dominating men who no longer have the wherewithal to make good decisions because of what they've been through in life. I think that caught on and it hit a nerve in the American public. I've always kind of maintained that there are noir people, even today, people that don't fit into the happy family's traditional idea of the American dream. We still have the American dream today. It still hangs on. And there are people that not only don't fit into it, but they don't want it. And we as a society tell them that they're wrong, they're bad, they need to be controlled. And so there's this constant tension. And I think we see it come out in many different ways. I'm not saying all mass shootings are a part of this, but I think that type of emotional leakage that leads to those types of things, those types of disasters, comes from this demand that people be normal and fill normal roles. And I think that's what film noir captured better than anything else at the time.
That's a fascinating way to look at it. And you know, just as a writer myself, I can see those concepts, you know, helping anyone who crafts noir fiction to, you know, kind of frame and gives you a lot to draw on as you craft those stories. I want to talk a bit about the Fight Card series. You know, what a concept that is. It's a series of short novellas written by various writers under a common pen name. And, you know, that was something that was done a lot back in the day when I was cutting my teeth on action fiction. I'm thinking of, you know, as a young teen at the flea market picking up the old Mac Bolan novels. And
sure.
Destroyer
novels.
You know, some of the old westerns. Yeah.
All that stuff.
So they were kind of anonymous writers under, you know, a brand or franchise. And I feel a lot of nostalgia when I think of that and when I see things like the Fight Card series. Is that something you had in mind with that project?
Well, it's exactly what we had in mind with the project. Mel Odom is a very prolific writer with several hundred books to his name. Is a friend of mine. He lives in Oklahoma, and we were having this late night conversation from LA to Oklahoma one evening, and we got talking about the boxing stories of Robert E. Howard, who is the creator of Conan. That's what he's known for best. But he had this character named Sailor Steve Costigan that he wrote these boxing stories about. And Howard himself believed that his boxing stories were more important than anything else that he was writing. He loved writing them. And Mel and I were kind of bemoaning the fact that those stories that used to exist in the pulp magazines and the sports pulps and everything just aren't around anymore. And part of the reason was that there's no market for 25,000 to 30,000 word novellas. There's, you know, there was no way to sell them or to place them or to distribute them. Well, of course, all of that changed with the advent of Amazon. And Mel and I kind of got excited and went, okay, hey, you know, we've got an opportunity to do this. Let's have some fun with this. So we decided to write two books. You know, I would write one, he would write the other, and they would be about two brothers. I would write one brother, he would write the other brother, and their connection was that they were raised in an orphanage in Chicago where Father Tim, the battling priest, taught them the sweet science in order to keep them in line and in order to teach them how to be men. So I write Felony Fists, and Mel writes a book called Cut Man, and we put them out under the title fight card, the overall title fight card, and we chose this pseudonym, Jack Tunney, obviously Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney combination mashup, and we threw them out into the world, thinking nothing of it. Well, the stories not only resonated with readers, but all of a sudden, a number of our writer friends were contacting us and saying, hey, it looks like a series. Can we write one of these? And, you know, that these were guys that were on the cusp of breaking out into the big time, guys like Terrence McCauley and Eric Beatner, who are now very well known in their own right, great writers. And so we started opening this whole series up to these other writers, and it became something of a unique animal. This was not a publishing company. This was an author's cooperative. And by that I mean we did the editing for each other, we did the formatting for each other, we created covers for each other, we promoted each other. Everybody had a role of helping everybody else who was on the team. And each book would be published by the author who wrote it on his own Amazon platform. So any money made from that book went directly to him. It wasn't that it came to a company, and you know, so there was really no paperwork. And this was, I have to tell you, this was one of the greatest experiences of my life. We just published the 50th book in the Fight Card series. 45 authors, 50 books over 4 years. They were coming out monthly. And I have made some great friends. I am a hugely better writer because of my experience in editing these books. And it was just so cool to see everybody coming together. I mean, we even put out two fight card anthologies, charity anthologies, where everybody contributed stories and the money went to either an author in need or a literacy project, because everybody needs more readers. And it was just, it was not exactly a profitable by any stretch of the imagination experience monetarily, but hugely profitable in life experience and friendships and just the joy of writing words and hanging with other authors.
Well, it's an amazing concept, and I love the fact that these are novella length stories, which I think is just the right size for a lot of these, you know, the crime plots, the boxing plots, you know, even noir itself. And you can binge on these things, and I just love them. Why is the low end of the boxing world a setting or situation that is so pregnant with possibility in the noir genre, would you say?
Well, I think it goes back to the nature of boxing itself. What it all finally comes down to, and that was one of the things we insisted on in the fight card stories, boxing had to be front and center. It couldn't just be a background to a crime story. Boxing had to be front and center. The main plot point had to be resolved in the ring by two men with just their fists. And if 50 novels, and every single one of them has that same framework, but is a completely different journey. And I think it's all about character. Noir is about character and our fascination with how things go wrong. And at the low end of boxing is where things go wrong most often. We expanded the Fight Card series not just to be about boxing in the 50s, but we did a line of Fight Card MMA, which brought it into the mixed martial arts world that is current today on the fight scene. And there were noir stories to tell there that at the low end of MMA. And we took it even a step further. Our best sellers were our three Fight Card Sherlock Holmes novels, where we take Sherlock Holmes, you know, canon, the four novels and 54 short stories, and the references to Sherlock Holmes and boxing in those stories, and expand upon them. And in fact, the last book we just published 2 weeks ago is an omnibus of those three Sherlock Holmes Fight Card stories, with a ton of other extra material woven in. And so look for that. People who love Sherlock Holmes have lauded these books as some of the best Holmes pastiches to come down the pike. So it's been a very pleasurable experience.
Well, yeah, it's a rich concept, and I look forward to seeing all that you guys do with that going forward. So, you know, Paul, we know you as a writer, LAPD detective, TV personality. I'm not sure all of our listeners are aware. I also know you as a collector. You're very engaged daily, I would say, in the men's adventure novels from the 1970s. You know, those books that I discovered as a young teen, and I got, most of them secondhand. I remember they were slim, they had exciting covers, and that was just a magic golden age for that kind of thing for me. How serious are you as a collector, and what draws you to that?
Well, I'm actually an avid collector of those types of books, because they were the pulps of my youth. The pulp magazines from the 40s and 50s, that was a little bit before my actual start of reading. And what I really got hooked into as a teen was these men's adventure novels with these lurid covers, and they really are the paperback equivalent of the pulps. Oftentimes the covers were what draws you into what was essentially mediocre writing. But some of it was great, powerful writing. And I was excited by the fact that, there were all these series and getting to know which authors were behind which pseudonyms and the stories behind the series themselves. It became a fascination for me, and I think I'm truly drawn in by the artwork on a lot of these books from the 70s. I think it's a highly overlooked art form. And so I enjoy saving books just for that reason. I actually have what I would refer to as a reader's library. I don't necessarily look for pristine copies of these books. I love having used copies in good condition, because books have stories of their own. I love the fact that they've been well read by others, and with the men's adventure paperbacks groups, this has been cool to tie in with a bunch of other obsessives in the same vein, and we've been trading books and talking books, and it's just been an exceedingly pleasurable experience for a bibliophile like me. Everybody's got to do something.
Right. Yeah. No, and I agree. They certainly don't make covers like that anymore. I think Hard Case Crime publishers, they're one that has some exciting covers these days.
Yes.
But they're kind of a throwback to some exciting covers from the past.
Sure. They've hooked into Robert McGinnis, which is, he's doing a lot of their covers, and he was the primo, most sought-after artist of his day at the time. He just delivered some great art, along with other names like Gil Cohen and Bruce Minnie and many, many others. And it also splashes over into the men's adventure magazines. I've actually just been part of a new release called Barbarians on Bikes, which looks at all the it's all the artwork from the men's magazines that had bikers on the front, outlaw bikers, and all the colorful stuff. And I was able to actually provide the afterword for that collection. And it is just a beautiful, beautiful book with beautiful, beautiful art in it. How you can find beauty in those types of things, I'm not really sure. But when you're a Norrish personality yourself, having been through 35 years of doing what I did, there is a beauty in it, and I find it very aesthetic.
Yeah, I can see that. which writers would you name as major inspirations for you as a writer?
There was out of the series that you're talking about, both Don Pendleton, who wrote the original 38 Executioner books, Mac Bolan books, was an inspiration, as was a Western writer by the name of Ben Haas, H-A-A-S, who wrote under the name John Benteen. And his two series, one featuring an adventurer named Fargo and another one featuring a half-white, half-Cherokee a character called Sundance. Those were his writing, I just think, was so visceral and exciting that I found inspiration in that. As far as personal mentors, and funny enough, I was talking the other day about Dennis Linz, who wrote under the name Michael Collins, wrote a number of Private Eye series, who was very kind to me. And Joe Wamba was a huge influence on me, of course, as he is on most police writers, and he is a friend. And there were a number of writers. Lawrence Block it was somebody who has been a constant throughout my career. He's always talked to me and encouraged me, and he is a guy that started his career back, you know, before even those Men's Adventure series, and he's still writing today, and he is a writer. And I think there's a difference between writers and authors. And writers are guys who get down and dirty and do the job that needs to be done on days when the muse doesn't show up at the typewriter or the computer keyboard.
Yeah, it's exciting to see some of those old Executioners and the Fargo novels coming back out and available in ebook.
I said, stand by for some exciting news in that vein for me next year.
Excellent.
And that's the tease I'm going to give
intrigued.
You.
I'm intrigued.
No.
I can't wait.
Can't go from there. Just leaving it out there.
All right. We'll keep that in mind. I'm actually reading right now about 75% through The Girl with the Deep Blue Eyes by Lawrence Block, and I'm just blown away by that book.
Yeah.
So where can people find you out there on the web and keep up with you, Paul?
Well, you know, the quickest place to catch up with me is at the website, which is paulbishopbooks.com. Obviously, all one word, run together. But also, you know, I have my Amazon page and those types of things. I do a lot of speaking appearances, not just about interrogation, but also about writing and things like that. So look for me in your area. You know, I think that anywhere you find good books, hopefully you will find a link to Paul Bishop.
Excellent. And what new and exciting projects are you working on these days that we can look forward to?
I'm almost done with the sequel to Lie Catchers, which is called Admit Nothing. A long time ago, when I was on the job, I always remember a motto that was admit nothing, deny everything, and demand proof. And so those will be the next three titles for Lie Catchers novels, Admit Nothing being the first sequel, and then Deny Everything and Demand Proof. So I think I've got at least enough titles to take me through the next three books.
Great. Definitely looking forward to those. Paul, I want to thank you for joining me on Noir on the Radio today. It's really been great having you on, and would love to get you back on when Admit Nothing comes out.
Terrific. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and you know, I appreciate your interest and your kind words.
Well, thanks. And for the listeners, I encourage you to check out Paul Bishop's books, Lie Catchers, the Faye Croker series, Fight Card. You can find them all easily on Amazon or where you find your fiction. Also, check out my latest, Road Carnage. It's the fourth in the Selena series. It's mean, it's nasty, and it's available now from All Due Respect Books. Until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.